That's right. The fans are out to get a ticket or two. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. It's Tuesday, two for Tuesday. Get your requests in. One artist, two songs. Get them in now. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. It's baseball season. And baseball season is underway, and so we thought we would talk to one of the best experts on baseball. He is the author of over 60 nonfiction books, many of which focus on baseball. His name is Paul Dixon. His latest is Leo Durocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son, and you can check out his website at Paul Dixon, DICKSON. PaulDixonBooks.com for more information. He's written a ton of books about baseball, so we're just going to talk about baseball and some of the books and some of the stories and all kinds of great stuff. He's been on the show many times. It's always a pleasure to welcome him back. And here is Paul Dixon. Paul, welcome back to the show, sir.
Thank you, Nick.
How are you? Great. Well, let's start at the beginning again to remind people, baseball has been part of your life. When did you become a big baseball fan from the moment you were a kid?
Yeah, I mean, I saw to show you how old I am, I saw my first game in 1944. My uncle had come back from the South Pacific, and he took me to Yankee Stadium. He was all dressed up in his enlisted man's Navy uniform with a Dixie Cup hat on, and we walked in. And, you know, at 44, a guy in uniform was treated like a king, and
yeah.
They took us right to the Yankee clubhouse. We didn't have to pay for anything, and my uncle got to talk to Tommy Hendrick, who was then in the Coast Guard, who was the famous Yankee infielder who was known as Old Reliable, and they put us down in the owner's box. And I said to my uncle on the way home, I don't remember this because I was only 4 years old. I said to my uncle, he said, I love baseball.
And did he say, well, this experience isn't the way it's going to be every time you come to the park?
No, he didn't say anything like that. It was. You know, it's still like this amazing thing when you first, you know, sort of forget about it during the winter and you sort of, all these other things going on and Christmas. And all of a sudden, it's here. And all of a sudden, you're just mesmerized again. And yesterday was the perfect baseball day. I wasn't at the stadium, but I was watching. The Orioles were playing a startup team in the Bronx, a rebuilding team, rather, in the Bronx. And the game started at 1. I was watching on TV. I stayed for a little bit. They were behind 5-0 in the first inning. I went. I did some chores and went to the store. I took a 2-hour nap. I did all these other things. I started making dinner. I turned it back on. It's in the extra innings. It goes on. The game, it was 4 hours and 48 minutes. So I caught it at the beginning. I caught it at the end. Phenomenal ending. The Yankees. But it was just, it's so funny because you're sort of in this new rhythm. And everybody's moaning and groaning about the game's last 2-1. And sometimes I wish they'd last longer.
Well, we had the Cubs had a nearly 5-hour game last Friday that went 7-10, and they ended up losing, but it went 7-10 innings, and it was over 5 hours. People stayed up until 1 o'clock in the morning to watch it.
I know, and of course that's the big, I think baseball is going through a year of transformation, and I think there are two things going on which are very interesting. One of these new regulations about restricting the time of the game.
Yeah.
And the mound visit thing is very interesting because as you may know, I did a book some years ago, which now needs updating, called The Hidden Language of Baseball. Mm-hmm. And it was about signs and sign stealing. Well, one of the things that's happened over the years is sign stealing has become much more refined, much more high tech. I mean, it's really espionage. And, that business last year that surfaced where the Red Sox were using a Google Watch, Apple Watch to spy on the Yankees.
Yeah.
Well, one of the reasons a lot of the go back and forth in the later innings between the pitcher and the catcher was to change the signs because there were so many of the signs were being stolen. So the catcher would go out there and say to the pitcher, okay, we're changing the signs all around, and it has nothing to do with my fingers down. It has to do with how I put my hand on my ear or something.
Yeah.
To throw it. So that's going to change, and it's going to be a much better time for sign stealers, which people forget about. You forget about everybody, including that bench coach, is out there trying to figure out, trying to decipher, trying to decode these signs going on. And my book on the sign stealing ended up in the Spy Museum for about 5 years.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, but it's really basically you know, it's one army is spying against the other army.
Right. When did that start, Paul? When did the sign stealing become a thing?
Right after the Civil War. And a lot of it was very interesting because there's a very lot of parallels to baseball in the Civil War. You know, the general was in uniform, the manager's in uniform. The sergeant was the catcher, sort of ran the field. The junior officers were the first and third base coach. And the language, you know, the battery, the pitcher and the catcher, et cetera, et cetera. And the Civil War is the first time that enlisted guys, you know, regular grunts, were able to do signs and signals. They were using lanterns. They were using flags. So as soon as, right after this, the first time somebody's caught, it's in a game in Hartford, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's caught stealing signs. They were sitting on a telegraph pole. And so it goes back, all the way back, because as soon as you got signs, the other thing was, how do you get an advantage? You know, you got a guy in second. And you know, what do you do? He's trying to figure out the signs so he can flash his own signs back to the batter and also tell the batter where the catcher is. So all of a sudden, strategy now involves not only the signs, but decoding the other team's signs. And they can make a tremendous difference. I remember Robin Yount told me that he and Molitor, between them, could win a game or two a year by stealing signs, especially when one of them got on second.
Wow.
You know, one or two games a year is a huge deal.
Yeah, that is a huge deal. Wow. So what were some of the other things, the hidden language you talk about? That's about signs. What else were some of the things that you talked about in that book?
Oh, I mean, basically, it was the volume of signs. The more people I talked to, the more I realized, and I was talking to people in Major League Baseball, umpires, hitting coaches, everybody I could lay my hands on. I mean, the fascinating thing was, a lot of times the signs, it could be the trainer sitting in the dugout, or it could be, you know, they don't always have to be first and third base coaches giving them. And some teams actually had, they were so afraid of being stolen that they had different, there have been teams out there that had different signs for every player on the field.
Wow.
Every offensive player. And some people were better at it than others. I mean, some people really got it to a fairly well. I mean, one of the reasons the Yankees used Don Zimmer as a bench coach was Zimmer was a genius at picking off signs. He would just read body language. And, of course, the other teams get, you know, very clever about what they're going to try to do. But I think the most interesting thing I found from that whole experience of researching that book, that if you took all of the signs, overt, covert, umpire signs, you know, second baseman, catcher moving people around the field, in a tightly played game, there are probably 1,000 signs given in.
Wow.
And a lot of it is, you know, people say, oh, baseball is just a bunch of individuals out there in the field. But if you actually look at the positioning, the way a Major League Baseball team positions itself defensively, you start to realize that there's a huge amount of communication going on that field, which you don't see. You know, how does the second baseman let the shortstop know who's going to cover and where they're going to move him to, and et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah. And what about meetings on the mound? That, you know, when did that become like a major thing? And then the umpires had to go out, they have to go out and say, hey, break it up.
Well, it's increased over time. In other words, it was once a rarity, but now with the tremendous number of relief pitchers, if you had left a pitcher in for the whole game, you might only have one or two. But then,
right.
Of course, that's one of the things they've restricted this year.
Right.
And they're playing around with some other stuff, which I'm finding very interesting. There was almost a rebellion in Portland, Maine, where they, you know, this new rule at levels of the minor leagues where they're gonna, in a tie game, they're going to put a guy on second.
Yeah.
For each team. And I was reading this story that a friend of mine sent me from the Portland Press Herald about how the fans are furious. You know, they say, wait a second. That's not baseball. That's dodgeball or something.
Right, right, right.
And now they're kicking around an idea that maybe what you do in the extra innings is you throw out the batting order. You put anyone up you want. And you say, wait a second. Because part of baseball, you know, the other thing is baseball is like an elevated highway, and you start knocking out pieces under the highway and you're in trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, statistically, baseball is, for somebody who's even vaguely interested in statistics and numbers and all that stuff, it all goes out the window if you start changing the rules.
Yeah, yeah. I was upset when they changed the intentional walk.
Yeah.
I want to see that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And also, the great thing with the intentional walk was, like, the guy, so the batter lurches out of the box.
Yeah.
is it? But,
yeah.
Yeah, and it was one more chance for a pass ball. It was one more chance for everything.
That's right, absolutely. I hated that when they did that, and some of the changes just don't. Some of the changes I'm not happy with. Some of the things that they're doing and some of the things that they're proposing, because in my estimation, baseball is about as perfect a game as you're going to see.
I have also some problems with the challenge, you know, where they go to New York for the television replay.
Yeah,
I was at a day game two years ago. And then with the Nationals in D.C. and it was a hot. It was like 92 degrees out there, and all of a sudden so the guys are out there in the sun, and there's a challenge. You know, challenges start going, and there was, I think there were two challenges in the game, but they were leaving the defensive team out in the field.
Yeah,
and the pitcher was actually almost sitting on the ground. He was down in a crouch sort of.
Yeah,
and it's really hot, and the fans. You're sitting there, and you're baking in the sun, and all of the stuff these guys with the headphones on. You're saying, "Get out of here! Get the game going.
Get to it. Get to the decision."
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, what about? Let's talk about the Dixon Baseball Dictionary. You're on the third edition of this one now.
I've done the third edition. I'm starting to work on the fourth. It's amazing because the last edition had over 10,000 entries, and it was 4.5 pounds.
Oh my God.
So it was cheap. It wasn't. If you bought the book by the pound, it was a $50 book in hardback. So if you bought it by the pound, it was pretty cheap. You know, if there was a scale in the bookstore.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, the language is changing a lot. I mean, the other thing that's really taking place is baseball is going through a transformation now between the old style, the scouts and the notebook and everything, and this avalanche of analytics. And all of a sudden, the language is changing. It's even getting into the sports course. You know, sportscasters are using it, and more managers are using that. And the other, I mean, there are other big changes. There's, I think it's over 20 teams now have mental skills coaches, which are basically psychologists who are out there trying to teach pitchers how to think in a positive way, how to image things, how to put things in their brain into the proper order, as if they were going to a practicing psychologist who was trying to help them succeed in business and how they eliminate negative thoughts. So you've got this whole new behavioral thing going on, and then you've got this other thing with the statistics. And in some places, the statistical stuff gets really wild because you have these statistics like wins above a replacement and wins above average and wins above this. So you're trying to rank every player, and it all started with Moneyball, at least in terms of the public understanding
it. Right.
But on one hand, you got the old thing, you know, the guys who still call them curveballs and still say a can of corn for a pop up.
Right.
And then the new stuff. So the language here, and I've in the last edition of the dictionary, I had to use a couple experts in statistics to help. They would write the rough. I'd get them to write the rough, and then I would turn it into English.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of, some of it, so there are formulas that look like something that a physics professor would draw on the blackboard.
Wow.
You know, it's baseball.
Yeah, it's amazing. Paul, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Paul Dixon is with us. He's a terrific writer, the author of over 60 nonfiction books, many of which focus on baseball. It's the baseball season, so we thought we'd have Paul on. We're going to talk more about many of his other books right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. That's the sound of spring. That's the sound of baseball right there, and we're talking baseball. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. 2 for Tuesday, get your request in now. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. We'll play them later. Paul Dixon is a terrific writer and the author of over 60 nonfiction books, many of which focus on baseball. His latest book is Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. And you can check out pauldixonbooks.com. That's D-I-C-K-S-O-N, pauldixonbooks.com. We have a link on our Facebook page as well. And let's welcome Paul back to the show. Paul, welcome back.
Thank you.
We talked about your Leo DeRocher book the last time you were on. It's a really terrific read, man.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And, nice connection there to Chicago. And, of course, you know, we talked about, you know, the relationship that Leo DeRocher had with the Chicago Cubs, and we talked about, and I did tell you about some of the things that Ron Santo once told me about his relationship with Leo. Quite a character, Leo DeRocher.
Yeah, and you know, it's, for me, it was interesting because I went from, my segue was between Bill Veeck.
Yeah.
And
by the way, also a terrific book, Paul.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. But those guys, I mean, a lot of ways, if you looked at Chicago as sort of the epicenter of baseball, insulting people in New York now and stuff, but if you look at Chicago, those two guys represented the Jekyll and Hyde of baseball.
Right. Right.
I mean, nobody didn't love Veeck. I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, I guess there are a couple stuffed shirts in the American League who got angry with him and such, but he was just such a breath of fresh air. And I think, you know, a lot of degree, what we owe Bill Veeck is the fact that we've got these tremendous, audiences. I mean, it was Veeck and his father, who was the president of the Cubs, which was the general manager today. They're the ones that really opened the ballpark, the father and son, with the idea of women and children. If you look at pictures of old ballparks, you know, circa like 19, whatever it was, it'd be just a sea of men in hats. You wouldn't see a kid, you wouldn't see a woman.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what they brought in. I mean, and Veeck would do these, young Veeck, Bill, would do these remarkable things. When he'd go to a ballpark, the first thing he did was rip out the women's rooms and put new women's rooms in with, you know, and he would doll them up. He would make great lighting. Most of the places were places with buzzing fluorescent lights.
Yeah.
Very clean. And when he goes into Cleveland, he puts in two nurseries, you know, with accredited nurses, so you can take an infant to the ball game and park him with a nurse.
Yeah.
I mean, and what they did was, the two of them, was they made baseball accessible. And the value of a present-day team, you can look and write, there's a direct line between getting the family there. It wasn't just for guys who got, you know, cut out of work early. It was they brought the whole family.
Yeah.
And a lot of those things, if you really can take back to the Veeck in Chicago and Veeck in Milwaukee when he's a minor league guy. But again, somebody said to me one day, what's the difference between Veeck and DeRocher? I said, well, if I was, somebody put me in a first-class seat in an airplane, and I found out I was sitting next to DeRocher, I'd ask to go back to tourist.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, it's a great way to put it. And there's so many amazing stories in both of those books. The Bill Veeck book, having grown up here, Paul, witnessing a lot of the stuff that he did firsthand. And as being a Cub fan, as I am, and not necessarily a Sox fan, he made me, want to go to Comiskey. He made me want to watch more Sox games, and I'm a National League guy. I'm a Cub guy, but that goes to, that's a testament to how loved this guy was by all baseball fans.
The tradition, even with his son Mike Veeck, who was still in the of the game, and very much a breath of fresh air, just like his dad. So, but I did, one of the funny things was, when I did the Veeck book, a certain writer who renamed Nameless in Chicago said, this should have been done by a Chicago writer. And I said, tough.
And I had heard that years ago, Bill Murray had the rights to Veck's story to be made into a movie, and he was going to play Veeck. But now, obviously, I think that's not going to happen.
I think it got sort of tied up. I mean, Mike told me that was true. I mean, Mike and Bill Murray are great, great friends.
Yeah,
they even have houses on the same block in Charleston. At least they did. And Mike, the River Dogs down in Charleston. I think it just got tied up in who owned them, and I mean, at one point I had hopes that he would revive that idea, but. It was true. There wasn't an option, but it just never worked out.
I think Bill Murray would have been great.
Oh yeah,
he would have been perfect. He would have been great to play that role.
Yeah,
yeah, amazing.
But I mean, but baseball has become so corporate and so different that it would almost be hard to believe. It would seem like a comedy that was imposed on baseball in the 20th century. when it was really, and there was room for, you know, Eddie Goodell, and there was room for, you know, be your own, you know, making the fans a manager.
Yeah.
And bringing, and, you know, he really, I mean, what Bill Beck did for racial integration should never be under.
It's true. Yep.
He, just amazing what he did with Larry Doby, with Satchel Paige, who, you know, the oldest rookie of the year in history.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. So I've loved to do the baseball stuff, and I'm going to start where I'm working on the revised version of the dictionary, and
right.
I'm working on a revised version of the hidden language. But I've started now working on the World War II book, so I'm taking a little breather from baseball.
So you're working on a book about World War II.
Yeah.
What's that covering?
It's gonna be really about the 1940 draft, and which very few people know about, and how we built an amazing army with draftees and put them through maneuvers and training before Pearl Harbor.
Mm.
So we were ready to basically take the Nazis on the ground, or just about, you know, we had a 2-million-man army, which we built from nothing. And it's a story that hasn't been told a lot.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of ball players in it, because the first guy, Hank Greenberg, the great Tiger slugger, is drafted right off the bat, and he's... The country's appalled, because in those days you didn't get an exemption. You could if you were certain, like a surgeon or something, but because you were a ball player or something, or you were in college, you didn't get an exemption. So
what's
a lot of baseball in it. It's really more about
What's the time frame on that? What are you looking for that one to come out?
Oh, in about, it'll be a little over a year.
All right. Well, you know, when it comes out, you got to come on the show.
I love it. And I know how versatile you are. You can talk about anything, so we can get into the World War II.
No, I appreciate that. I would do it, because I just think you're a terrific writer, Paul. It's always a pleasure to read your stuff.
Nick, you're so kind to me. I'm sitting here blushing.
Oh. So this is Paul Dixon, author of over 60 nonfiction books. You can go to pauldixonbooks.com. That's D-I-C-K-S-O-N, pauldixonbooks.com, many of which are about baseball, and it is baseball season. Paul, I always always look forward to talking to you, and it's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Nick.
Appreciate it. Take care. There you go. Paul Dixon, tremendously talented man, and we thank him for joining us this morning. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We got the news coming up next.